It's Thursday, May 24th, 2018. And you're listening to Last Time on Video Games, the show about retro video games and sometimes some other stuff. You're listening to episode 225, National Just Nukem Day. Runtime for this episode is 1 hour 11 minutes. Hello and welcome to Last Time on Video Games, the podcast that is 100% Infinity War spoilers. My name is Thor Dice.
I'm building a platform upon which to place my buddy nation state. I'm Tyler.
I'm just looking to wreck Tyler's nation state. My name is Zach.
Also, I'm Jeremy. I'm not Zach.
Well, you're not Thor Dice?
Thor may or may not die in that movie.
I know probably.
Did you know is in that movie?
I told you about that one. Spoiler that I saw that was spoilers with no context, and it's and a power-up mushroom from, or a super mushroom from Super Mario.
I need to watch the Thor movie
Jeremy loaned me. You should. It's very good.
Ragnarok?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've heard it's great.
Also, its sense of humor is very Zach.
It's just sitting over there next to all of my other stuff that I need to watch.
I don't need it, so it can sit there as long as it wants, as far as I'm concerned, but it's quite good.
It's on my list. I need to see Get Out still. I need to watch Black Panther.
Get Out is so good.
Yeah.
Black Panther is pretty good, too.
I still need to watch Infinity Wars.
Get Out is one of those that I've heard is really, really good, but it's very much, I've also heard that it's not my kind of movie.
Yeah, it's probably...
It sounds like it's probably your kind of movie, but I like explosions and car chases and stupid stuff, so Get Out is very psychological, as I understand it.
It does have explosions, a car chase, and some stupid stuff. I think you would really like the ending. Watching A Quiet Place, I was like, oh, this is a CinemaSins that Zach is going to enjoy a lot.
It's so good, though.
It's pretty good.
A Quiet Place.
It's a sci-fi premise that clearly the set designers and director care a lot about, and the writers and actors don't. So there are lots of, hey, wait a minute, why don't you just X things in there?
Yeah, I get a lot of my movies through CinemaSins at this point.
Yeah, me too, actually. It almost has like a Signs-esque ending, instead of ending it with like, and then they save the world, it's like, and then... Imagine them just beating the crap out of these monsters for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, that's cool. I actually like that ending note.
Yeah, I like every part of A Quiet Place. I just don't think it quite adds up to a full good movie.
I think it's a good movie.
But it's a series of well-acted, very well-shot scenes.
That is true. It is that.
Anyway, this is not a movie podcast. But instead, we played Rise of Nations, so we're going to talk about that. But we haven't recorded in like a year, so we're probably going to talk about what we've been playing before that. Zach, how's BattleTech?
So, as Jeremy has alluded to, you might not have caught it, I've been playing BattleTech for pretty much since we last recorded. I've got something like 80 hours in on Steam at this point, and I've only done like, I think, 3 or 4 story missions because I've been tooling around just taking other contracts and whatnot.
So when you do the story missions, you're going to be hilariously overpowered?
Oh yeah, the last story mission I did, I was hilariously overpowered. It was pretty funny. BattleTech, for those who don't know, is a translation of the board game or tabletop game BattleTech. So a lot of people are referring to it as Harebrained Schemes BattleTech because they're the guys that actually made it.
You might be more familiar with the MechWarrior series of shooters that is based on the same source material.
Yes, MechWarrior, Mech Commander.
Ignores a lot of the, mechanics in favor of action.
The game takes place, the campaign is just, you're playing a mercenary unit. You take contracts, you try and stay solvent while trying to end up getting involved in a civil war.
I played the tutorial.
So I wanted to ask Tyler about this. What did you think of the character creation? Because I've heard a couple of people talking about it. What did you think?
I had literally no opinions on it. It was more in-depth than I was expecting it to be, I guess. So there's that, but other than that, like, I had basically no opinion on it.
Okay. What did you think of the tutorial?
The tutorial was alright. I feel like I know how to play the game more or less. I feel like I need a couple, hard scenarios for me to understand the nuances of the tactics a bit better, but...
Because I've seen all kinds of people complaining about the game having a lack of tutorial, and I heard Kevin mention that he didn't really care for that character creation, because each choice affects a starting stat.
Yeah, it tells you, though,
But it doesn't tell you what they do.
It doesn't tell you what the stats
do. Oh, yeah, that's true. I guess... Oh, no, I just knew enough about BattleTech going in that I know what those stats
Kevin's
are.
Kevin's played
so.
BattleTech, and some of those stats don't exist in the tabletop game.
There are two stats in the tabletop game. They are piloting and gunnery.
Yeah.
There's no guts stat. There's no tactics stat, so you don't actually know what those do.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense what Guts does.
Unless you carry a really, really big sword.
The closer you are to 100 Guts.
I just picked the choices because they're done as like a background thing. So you pick, you know, where your character was from, what happened, and like, why are they out running around, what they did.
And then you die in character creation.
No.
Failure. Go on.
So you pick each one of those, and each one of those has some kind of effect on your character's starting stats. But yep. At the end of things, like, I have maxed out stats, so that really ends up not mattering that much. But I just picked the ones that I thought would make the most interesting story for my character.
Yeah, I mostly just chose, like, an interesting story for my character.
Yeah, I didn't even notice until I was almost done with it, now that I think about it, before I noticed that it actually had effects on your stats. So a lot of the things that they decided to do in Battletech, there's one thing that they changed that I didn't care for, and that is the loss of a torso location hurts the pilot.
I mean, that makes sense to me.
As it, like, blows into the cockpit or something.
Although the cockpits are in the head, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But in the tabletop game, you don't take pilot damage from losing a torso location. But by the same token, they also made it so that ammunition explosions won't kill your mech. Because the time frame this game takes place is before Case becomes a thing again. So one ammunition explosion would just kill a mech. So it makes ballistic mechs actually worth fielding.
Because you can actually, like, kill someone by just blowing up.
You would be able to, but since they changed it, your mech is now not going to immediately die if somebody so much as looks at its ammo bins. I've seen all kinds of people complaining and whining about head hits, claiming that the AI gets more of them than they do.
Has anyone actually bothered to, like, get statistics on that? Or
probably not. I haven't really noticed it. Well, I have noticed that the AI gets more head hits than I do. I have also noticed that the AI often fields twice as many units as I do.
Yeah.
So that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, because they're taking more shots.
Every time someone posts on the Battletech International forum, because on Facebook, that I'm part of that group, my immediate response is, I get them at the same rate the AI does. They get more because they've got more guns.
Yeah, so rate is really, I feel, what's important there.
There's a lot of things that are nice for Battletech players. Like, I know certain things, like a mech shows up and I'm like, oh, that's a catapult. I know how to deal with this. I know exactly what it can do. I know what its weak points are. That has actually shot me in the foot once because there are some vehicles in the game. There are 3 80-ton vehicles in the game. There is a tank called the Demolisher 2 in Battletech. It weighs 100 tons. It's got an Ultra AC-20 and an LBX-20 for some nouns. The standard Demolisher 1 weighs 80 tons and has 2 AC-20s on it. I didn't know it was 80 tons, so I saw 80-ton tank. The 2 other 80-ton tanks, you want to get in close because they're heavy, heavy ranged stuff.
Yeah, this one has AC-20s on it.
I had a guy get up close and personal with it, and it blew his head off.
As I say, you say nouns I don't understand, Zach, but the thing you don't get is that the AC-20 is one of my favorite weapons in all of fiction. So
I've got a full lance of assault mechs and some other things. We're gonna eat it. So the game is structured so you only control one lance at a time because game balance reasons, I guess. And because even now, some of the battles take a long time, like 15, 30 minutes per 4-on-4 battle or even longer. So some people are complaining that they wanted more than that. But at the same time, when I initially backed the campaign, it was backing at a lance skirmish level. So yep. I'm perfectly okay with that.
Because that's pretty much what the game is. So,
and they have a surprisingly in-depth mercenary campaign where, like I said, I've just been kind of tooling around the inner sphere, taking contracts and trying to stay solvent because the only way to actually game over in that game is to go into the red.
You know, that's actually one of my favorite things about a well-made single-player campaign is that there's just stuff to go do and you, like, get distracted from the story because there's just too much cool stuff. Well,
and, like, I want to go to different planets because I want to salvage myself an Atlas.
Spoilers for what I'm going to talk about. That's my favorite part of Wind Waker.
Yeah, mine too, actually. So
I got to mention, though, that there are some bugs in the game. I think there's a memory leak. And according to a bunch of people I've seen, there's a it's using 100% of the GPU and it really shouldn't be.
Yeah, that seems like a graphics programming
I think
problem.
It's a Unity problem. Playing it too long makes it load too long.
That does sound like a memory leak, actually.
Yeah, and sometimes I've found playing it for a bunch and then trying to start it again after I played the game a bunch, like a day later or something like that, it won't load. I'll have to restart my PC in order to get it to work.
Yeah, and I really feel like that's holding on to resources somewhere. Star Realms, the competitive deck-building card game, I have an app for it on my phone, and it just hinks my entire operating system even after I've killed it. But I still play it all the time, so
I still really like that game, but in Battletech, one of the major things in the game is mech customization, and this actually really goes into just ever, like it kind of attaches to everything because they went with the hard point system from MechWarrior Online. So each mech has a certain set of hard points. You can't just put anything on a mech. The mech has to have a point for it.
That makes sense.
So you can't just plug and play with whatever it is you want. So you have to have this specific setup in order to use it. But it also means that in the campaign, if a weapon is damaged or destroyed, you have to have a replacement for it. And sometimes I have found one of the things that I find the most fun has been having a mech lose a gun and then discovering it didn't have a replacement for it. And then having to try and figure out what to do with it. And at one point, a little minor spoilers, I have gotten a mech that has Star League era tech on it. It has double heat sinks, a Gauss rifle, and some other stuff. Nice. I don't field that mech except in story missions.
Because you don't want to risk losing pieces of it?
Because I can't replace those pieces. So it's like, I could field this in every mission and risk losing it. Because one thing I didn't mention, I'm actually playing this as an Iron Man.
Oh, nice.
So
I like that. Maybe I should too. I'm probably not good enough.
Like I said, I lost one of my pods when he got turned into goo when an AC-20 went through his cockpit. I lost one of my best pilots when an enemy grasshopper smashed her cockpit in. I lost two other pilots through just straight damage. And another mega spoiler here, but I don't really care. Decker dies.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all, frankly.
This guy starts as a light pilot, and it seems like everybody has this guy die. Decker dies has become like a meme for this game at this point.
Oh, I thought he meant he plot dies.
He's a random mech warrior. The main character, which is Lady Arano, your character, and those are like the two main characters of the game on your side, and your character can't die.
But everyone around them can. So
everyone else
like,
can.
You're just like an endless cavalcade of tragedy.
Well, so like your character, even if their cockpit is destroyed, they're just in the medbay for a really long time.
Do you get to choose what house you're from in this game?
You can, yes.
Okay.
That's the first choice you make.
Definitely playing Rei Ayanami from Space Japan.
The Draconis Combine.
Yeah, I was going to say Space Japan is one of the options because I couldn't remember any of the names.
I thought that was the Kajita, but that was Space Japan. I thought the Kajita were.
Is the Kuritans.
Kuritans, okay.
The House Kurita is the head of the Draconis Combine.
Okay, gotcha.
Because of it's since Battletech is a feudal system,
yeah.
A lot of times people interpose the house name and the actual faction name.
Okay.
Like House Davian is the Federated Sons. House Steiner is the Lyran Commonwealth.
Gotcha. Okay.
House Lannister or Lyran Alliance.
Sorry. Lyran Alliance. The Federated Commonwealth was when House Davian married House Steiner and that opened up a whole another can of worms. This takes place in a little non-canon area right now between the Taurian Concordat, the Capellan Confederation, and the Federated Sons.
Anything else about MechWarrior?
I didn't play any MechWarrior. I've been playing Battletech too much.
Look, I was going to retake that, but then you said that. So.
Yes, I wanted to be snide. It's a really fun game. I haven't played any multiplayer because I haven't been able to run one of these guys down to play it because they've been busy.
I want to, actually. It sounds like a lot of fun. Like I said, I'm probably going to get creamed, but
it is fun. And in all honesty, I think there are some things that would work better in multiplayer because you don't have these godlike pilots that I have at this point. Because basically all the pilots I field have 10s down the board, which is max stats. And because if you're dealing with a human intelligence, they're going to be maneuvering more. So you're not just worried about being overwhelmed in pure numbers.
Is that mostly what playing against the AI is? It's just like
the difficulty seems to ramp up by pure numbers. And Bulwark is a really powerful skill because it halves all damage coming at you if you don't move.
Gotcha. So you can just have like some people just go tank.
And at this point, I field 4 assault mechs, which have insane levels of armor. Trying to punch through my King Crab takes forever. I should know I had to kill 2 of them to get it. Because, I guess I should mention that part real quick. In Battletech, usually if you kill a mech, you can salvage it whole cloth. Usually, you know, in all the other games, like MechWarrior 4 Mercenaries, you kill a mech, you can salvage in the mech. MechWarrior or Mech Commander 2, you could just salvage it, get, you know, full thing. Whatever, pay a couple C-bills. The way they did it in this one is, when you salvage mech, you have to get 3 pieces of it. Like, if you destroy everything, or destroy the center torso, you only get 1 piece. Then, like, killing the head or both legs or something gives you all 3 pieces. And there's a way to get 2, but I don't actually know how to do that. But if you salvage all 3 bits, you get everything that comes with the mech on it.
Okay.
So it comes fully loaded. So whereas a lot of those other ones, you salvage the chassis, but you don't salvage the guns that go with it. And so when you take contracts, you negotiate, you know, how much money do I want versus how much salvage do I want? And I usually leave it in the center if I don't absolutely need the money, but I always leave 1 spot so I actually can pick 1 thing of salvage at least, because just in case that level does have something I really wanted, like the last assassination mission I wanted, or I went on. The guy was piloting an Atlas. I want an Atlas, and I pretty much tore it apart. So I only salvaged one piece of an Atlas. So I've got one third of an Atlas ready to go for my lance of two Highlanders, a King Crab, and a Victor.
That was actually one of my favorite mechanics in Subnautica, is that you don't just like get things, you have to go find pieces of things scattered around.
Like, I saw some people complain, like, why isn't this there? Why does this work like that? Well, it works like that because, you know, you don't have to buy all the bits. You don't have to buy all the guns for it. I mean, there are a couple of story missions where they give you a chassis. Like, the first, like, major story mission you can complete, they give you a 50-ton Centurion chassis, but they don't give you any of the guns for it. Someone was on the forum, I don't know what this has. I don't know what the standard configuration for it is. I'm like, I'm a Battletech nerd. I know exactly what the standard configuration for this mech is. I didn't have the pieces for it. I did not have an AC-10 in my inventory. So I couldn't. I wanted to, but I couldn't. I looked at the achievements, and I'm one of like 1% of people on Steam who has gotten the achievement for doing over 100 mercenary contracts.
So you have played this game quite a bit.
Yes. 80 hours. That is 4 days, almost.
And I'm also one of only a 1-point-something% of people that has unlocked the achievement Highlander Burial. Kill a light mech with a Highlander DFA.
Yep. I feel like that's an achievement in like multiple Mech Warrior games.
That would surprise me, since this, I think, is the first one that actually incorporates physical combat.
I don't know. I feel like there was one where a valid tactic would... It might have been MechWarrior 2. That was an old-ass game.
Maybe. This is the one... Like, this is the modern one that I'm familiar with that actually incorporates physical combat. Which makes me does hold out hope for the Axeman or the Hatchetman coming. Not much hope, because I think they're still going to be drawing a lot of their models from PGI's MechWarrior Online. And they don't have physical combat, so the Axeman and Hatchetman wouldn't make an appearance. But, man, it would be fun to have those.
You can always hope.
Yeah.
Don't complain vocally on a forum about it.
One of these little things about the game that I really, really like. So I modified a Victor, which normally has one big AC-20. I gave it two AC-2s instead and made it into this, like, sniper. But you can see that it's been changed. So the model actually, instead of having one big barrel on that arm, has two small barrels there.
Oh, nice.
And I'm like, I really like that. The model changes based on what the thing is carrying. So
yeah, actually, frankly, anymore, I'm more just disappointed if it doesn't in most games. Like, it seems like such a standard thing anymore that I've, like, it's weird to see it not happen.
Yeah, so I would recommend Battletech if you have any, like, love or desire to play any kind of tactical game. Like, it reminds me a lot of XCOM or Fire Emblem. And if you play it on hardcore or, you know, Iron Man like I am, well, you lose a pilot. You're up a creek. I have one of the Kickstarter backers on my team. There are like 5 or 6, I think, Kickstarter backers that were like at $2,000 or something like that. Got their MechWarrior.
But if you're about to go in the red, can you run a crowdfunding campaign for your mercenary service?
Nope. Although I have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple million C-bills worth of mech chassis that I just have in storage. Because you have mechs in your bays that you can actually deploy, and then you have all of your other mechs in storage, which take a couple of days in order to get out of storage. Oh man, I think that's my favorite, like, side feature, is that there is travel time and there is repair and refit time. So it's not just a matter of, I want to put this gun on here for this mission.
It takes time to
refit the mech you're using. Granted, you can reduce that time through upgrades, but it's one of those neat little touches, because Battletech, one of the things about it is it takes time to travel from system to system. And I really like that they caught the feeling of, yeah, I'm going to go over to that system. It's going to take me a few days, though. I've made sure I made enough money so I can afford to pay my financials, because it's going to take me time and I'm going to have to pay them before I get there.
Anything else, Zach?
I picked up Digimon Hacker's Memory.
I almost picked that up because Target had a buy one game, get two free sale. Buy two, get one free. And that was one of two games I was like, I could buy that.
I have a funny story about this one before I actually talk about the game itself. I saw a Watch Mojo video talking about the top, like, 10 Digimon games.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was either this one or Cyber Sleuth. I mean, it was that series that was at the top of the list. I'm like, oh, it's been a while since I played a Digimon game, and it's dangerous for me whenever I have something like that happen when I'm really tired, and I was really tired.
Because then you buy 10 of them.
No, my impulse control seems to go down. So when I'm really tired, I buy stuff, more stuff than I really should. But so I went over to GameStop, saw it, and, you know, put it on the counter. I was like, okay, the clerk rang me up for Resident Evil 4 in this game. And it came out to like $70-something. And I'm like, oh, that's odd. And then she, you know, went to get the games. And I'm like, oh, so that must be where it is. Okay. And then she looked at me like I was an idiot. And I'm like, That wait, how is it that? And she's like, no, that's how much it costs. Really? How does it cost that much? They're only $20. And then she picked up the box like I'm some kind of moron and pointed to the $34 sticker on it. Oh, I'm dumb. Like, do you want to change it? No, I'm good. So I was like, all right. But I'm having a lot of fun. I've got a lot of reminiscent memories of Persona 5 because you have I go into the digital world and then I have to spend some time running around outside the digital world doing other things. So
you make it sound like there's a portion of the game that's like more enjoyable than the other here.
Well, it's more that for you, you think this is like Persona. For me, Persona is just my adult Digimon fan fiction come to life where I have real romance arcs and murder demons. You become friends enough with your friends and their Digimon evolve, Zach. It's just Digimon.
I had that feeling just because of the game mechanics, but I'm having fun with it. It's not nearly as complicated as some other games, but it's enjoyable. The combat works fairly well. It is fairly standard JRPG combat, but, you know, what else are you going to do?
So what is the dumb mechanic that makes you de-digivolve your Digimon? Because every Digimon game has one.
There is an optional mechanic, but I've not actually used it yet, so I don't know exactly what it does.
Okay. So it's not like Digimon World 2, where every time your Digimon level up, you have to send them back an evolution level for them to raise their level cap.
As far as I know, no. I mean,
few Digimon games have been that punitive about it since then.
Yeah, because, I mean, whenever you Digivolve them, they go back to level 1.
Yeah.
But the level cap is raised.
And their stats probably go up from where they were, or they're pretty similar.
Yeah, I think so. So they don't actually have, like, you know, you have to de-digivolve them to do something. You might be able to de-digivolve them and keep stats, but I don't actually know yet. I'm fairly far into it, and the main reason why I stopped playing the game where I did wasn't because it was too hard, or, you know, I got bored of it, or anything like that. It was because Battletech came out.
And we can see what influence that had on you. So,
well, it's a game that I know from my childhood. Or, you know, the series I know from my childhood, which would be both. And a series that I haven't really done anything with for a while, being Digimon. Or the series that I'm actively engaged with a group and talking about pretty much all the time and have multiple friends that do the same thing, which would be Battletech. I do think when I play against you for the first time, though, Tyler, I think we'll do Recon Lances because that way it'll stay fair.
I don't know what that means.
Okay, mostly Lights. I'll play Steiner Recon Lance. We'll have you play something else.
It's a trap.
It's not a trap. A Steiner Recon Lance is just like every other Lance.
I'm dubious just based on the shit-eating grin you got on your face. So.
Yeah, Zach doesn't have a poker face at all.
Not in this case. The Steiner Recon Lance is commonly thought of as being four assault mechs.
Ah, okay. That's not a Recon Lance at all.
Well, when a Steiner standard battle strategy is line up the atlases and walk it whatever it is that they want dead and hope it dies along the way, their 80-ton Zeus is a scout mech.
Speaking of dying along the way, Tyler, what have you been playing?
So I was trying to decide which of the games I've been playing that are tangentially similar to what Zach's been playing that I should talk about. Let's go with D-Digital Evolution. Mostly because I've been playing Disgaea 5. I can't remember if I talked about that on the podcast ever.
You told me.
Yeah, I told you.
I don't think it was on the podcast.
I was playing Disgaea 5 a while back.
It's a good game. It's Disgaea.
I don't remember why I stopped playing, and I think something else came out.
I can see that happening. Mostly, like, I have this weird nostalgia factor for Disgaea, even though I only played the first one, like, 4 or 5 years ago.
Is that the one I played?
You played Disgaea 5.
Okay.
On PS4? Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Are you playing it on, you're playing it on the Switch with all the DLC and stuff on there?
Yep. I'm mostly ignoring the DLC, though, because it's, like, characters from other Disgaeas, and, like, that's weird for some reason.
Isn't Etna one of them?
Yeah, you can get characters in the original Disgaea. In Disgaea 2, Etna is like an actual playable character who shows up as part of the plot. Laharl's gone, because apparently they couldn't hire someone to do a cheesy laugh, so.
I thought at one point somebody was theorizing that Laharl was the main character of that.
That might have been me, because they look very similar. They exist in the same universe at the same time, though? And, like, he keeps having flashbacks to a person I'm, like, 90% sure is Flawn, but he calls her something else, so. I don't know. The reason that's at all similar to what you're talking about is that you can reincarnate characters, and I did that for the first time recently.
I don't think I ever did that.
It does incentivize you a whole lot. The problem is you unlock more and more specialized classes, and like I started with a standard healer and then unlocked like angelic host or something to that effect, which are just way more effective healers and way less general. I'm like, well, really, that's what I wanted her to be in the first place. Like, as you go through the game, you unlock more and more specific character classes as you need more and more specific roles.
I think I had a Black Knight or something was one of the characters that I was regularly fielding.
Yeah, Armor Knights are really nice because you can just send them out and tank. They actually get aggro abilities. I'm trying to think of like...
They had what, like no mana, if I remember right.
Yeah, they have basically no mana. They just sit there and take hits, which is nice. Moral of the story, bunch of specialized classes. I'm really enjoying it. It's a Disgaea. What's weird about it, though, is it feels very, very similar to the original Disgaea. Like, there haven't been a lot of changes, as far as I can tell.
It felt very Fire Emblem-y to me, because it has a very similar interface.
Yeah, the combat system is fairly similar, although the actual combat works a bit differently, because they're, like, the combine attacks.
Yeah,
and, like,
the combat works a lot differently, but the interface reminded me a lot of it. Have you gotten the rabbit?
Yeah, just did fairly recently.
You probably did that smarter than I did. I had to do that level twice.
Okay, actually... So I wasn't sure whether or not I could kill her, so I did actually have to do that level twice.
Oh, okay, I killed her too.
So the problem is, though, I let her tank most of the hits, and then I, like, walked up there. I'm like, well, she seems to be preferentially attacking the enemy, so I'm just going to go up there. And then she, like, did a berserker rage thing on me and killed, like, three of my characters. I'm like, oh, well, I guess I misunderstood that. So I went up and just, like, wailed on her and left her with, like, 16 HP, but that was the first attack I had landed on her. Because it was just like an endless combo series that I just lined up and executed. And then the game's like, oh, by the way, don't touch her. And I'm like, well, she's only got 16 HP left. You could have told me that, you know, 2,000 hit points ago. That would have been nice.
I don't think that one is well telegraphed that you're not actually supposed to attack that character. Because I think there's another one where you... Yeah, because the other like main character you get, the red-haired giant guy.
Red Magnus.
You're supposed to take him down.
Yep.
Like, you actually do beat him up, and they don't really telegraph that, in this case, beating her up loses you the level.
Yeah, it's not even just a lose the level, it's a game over, and it's like this story about how the main character leaves the army and it slowly dissolves without his leadership.
It's a bad end,
yeah. Disgaea does that, actually. It has a lot of different endings.
It's just weird, because it's not well telegraphed that you're not supposed to kick the crap out of his character.
And I think the only thing that you get is kind of a hint is one of the worlds before... You can optionally get an enemy overlord if you let him live. He's the moth guy. Yeah, like, he's a no character, basically. But if you let him live, you get a moth guy on your team for free. So.
I think I murdered him.
Yeah, and, like, they attack you, so you're incentivized to murder him. But I just kept picking him up and throwing him away. So that's actually how I deal with most of my problems in this game, is I just huck him.
I destroy them.
You haven't seen that Squirrel Girl comic, huh?
Uh-uh.
I don't even remember who it is. She's fighting someone that, like, can't physically be hurt, so she keeps just grabbing him and throwing him into the air. She's like, well, you can't do anything to me up there, so I'll just keep throwing you into the air forever, I guess.
That's pretty good.
That was a Ryan North comic.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a Ryan North thing.
Anyway, anything else, Tyler?
I had one last thing to say about that, but I can't remember what it was.
Good, I cut you off, yes.
Oh, Prinnies. Nice. Oh, I was going to say, I've got, like, a surprisingly large amount of playtime in that game, but I think most of it has been spent in item worlds. I got a joke item. I got a sword that's a bouquet of flowers. So obviously I'm using that nonsense. So I went to go level up that nonsense.
Is that a really good mechanic or a really tedious mechanic? Having never played a Disgaea game, I can't decide what I think.
Both? It seems like it should be tedious. I have a lot of fun doing it. So.
Okay, nothing is a grind if you have fun doing it.
Yeah.
So.
I think because the levels are randomized enough, and, like, I have a lot of fun trying to, like, come up with geostone destruction chains, which are kind of a main mechanic for, like, end-of-level bonus scores. So I spent a fair amount of time doing that. Like, I try not to do it a whole lot because there's not a lot of plot there, and also I have an audience while playing this game, so...
Well, I just know the Penny Arcade guys really like Disgaea because one of them really liked the plot and doing all the missions, and the other one would just level up all his items because all he wanted to do is, like, the combat and stuff, and he didn't care about the story.
I will say the combat is definitely the best part about this game. It's pretty solid. But also, this, like, I don't know, it's a pretty cheesy anime plot. The other thing I've been doing, not a whole lot yet, and I intend to play a lot more, related to turn-based mech combat, is I finally just bit the bullet and bought Into the Breach. Which
is it
good? Oh, I keep looking at that.
It's good. You remember all that time you dumped into FTL?
No.
It is basically FTL, except the combat, instead of being real-time ship combat, is surprisingly in-depth turn-based grid mech combat.
That's why I kept looking at it, but everyone kept saying that it took forever.
Yeah, I have not completed a single run of it. It is roguelike in the same way that FTL is, though, so if you die, you just start over with a different, like, set of starting units. It is really good, so... I'm probably going to lose a lot of time to that game.
I may end up adding it to the list, but right now it would be at the bottom of even just my mech combat list.
Anything else, Tyler?
Yes, actually. Anything else? I'm trying to remember what else.
Slay
else?
Inspire. Or are you saving that for last?
Oh, no, I have another game I'm saving for last. So yes, Slay the Spire released the beta for their in early access game character, which is their third character, which I've been waiting for a while. He plays really weird by comparison to the other guys.
What is he?
He is
What's his name?
I can't remember. The Derelict or something? Maybe the Decrepit?
Frank? Okay.
He is a, like, one of those third area robot guys who's, like, lost his memory.
I feel like I know what you're talking about, but...
In the third area, there are a lot of floating robot guys. Occasionally, you can find some bipedal robot guys.
Okay.
He is one of the bipedal robot guys.
Huh.
His main mechanic is that he summons orbs that have different effects. The starting orb is a thunder orb that just, if you have it out at the end of your turn... does 2 or 3 damage, I can't remember, to a random enemy. Or if you summon an orb, it has a more powerful version of that same effect. I think in this case, it like lightning does 8 damage to a random enemy. So your big thing is around mostly trying to figure out like optimal orb placement.
Huh, sounds kind of shaman-like in like the WoW TCG.
Yeah, actually. It's
Where you're just dumping out totems?
Yeah. Yeah, basically you're dumping out totems so that you always have passive effects. So like, one of the most valuable cards you can get is a power that just increases the number of slots you can have for orbs because you only start with 3. Or just like dumping a bunch of ice orbs, which just give you shield at the end of combat. There are dark orbs which gain damage the longer they're out and then dump it all at once when you finally pop them. And plasma orbs which give you more actions per turn.
Huh.
It's a really interesting character. He relies a lot on zero cost cards. And has a couple of things of like get zero cost cards out of your discard pile and back into your hand. So it's really weird. I think I've gotten to the third area once with him after like 5 plays.
Huh. I got to a point where I could very consistently get to the third area with the other two characters.
Yeah, I got to the point where I can more or less consistently beat the game with the other two characters. And like, I just don't understand how to play this character, I guess. He has a card called Claw, which only does 3 damage, but every time you use it, all claws in your deck do 2 more damage for the rest of combat, which seems like it's really good, but I can never get enough of them to really make it worth having even one of them, so...
Huh.
Oh, no. Like, it's obviously still in beta, because a lot of the cards don't even have artwork yet. It just says beta, where the artwork would be. And, like, it's clear they're still figuring out how to, like, balance him a little bit. Presumably, at some point, one of the devs beat the game with him, otherwise I can't imagine that they would have released him, but it's... Oh, no. It's a lot of fun. Unfortunately, at least when I played it, you had to sign up for their actual beta access, which means you lose all your progression while you're on the beta. Or any of the unlocks you've gotten for the other characters
you lose.
Go away. They did retool the other characters a little bit, though. So they added some more cards to the sneaky thief one whose name I can't remember. And it's not the plague.
I thought you said it was the shadow.
The silent. There we go. They're called the silent.
It is the silent.
I don't know. It's still a fun game. It still feels like... I've been having a lot of fun playing the wizard, mostly because the game's kicking my ass again, which is weird. Like, I got bored of the game as I started doing too well with it, which
because
is
because then the runs take too long. Like,
yeah, exactly.
The Spire takes just too long.
Yeah, it's like an hour and a half-ish, I want to say. I don't know, like, I'm even skipping most of the text anymore. The other thing I picked up, randomly, I don't know, so I beat Detective Pikachu finally. I forgot about that.
Final thoughts?
Were you right?
I don't know. They left it as a cliffhanger. The game ends on kind of a cliffhanger. Which
that's unsatisfying.
Yeah, actually, it ends on a false ending first, and then a cliffhanger, which is actually pretty good, where Pikachu, well, I'm not even sure if I should spoil it. Pikachu plays a joke on you and pretends like he's lost his ability to talk and is just, like, eating kibble out of a tray. The main character starts having, like, a breakdown, and is like, ah-ha-ha, gotcha, asshole! Which is actually really good. But, like, the game ends without a resolution to the main plot line, which is, where's my dad? And, like, Pikachu had to make a decision with Mewtwo. Mewtwo's like, all right, you did what I asked you to. Now I'll do one of the 2 things I promise you. And then you don't get to know what those things are or what got chosen or, like, where your dad is. So they're setting up for a sequel. It's not a sequel I'm sure I'm going to play because...
That's really unsatisfying.
Yeah, the actual gameplay in the game is, like... Oh, no, Ed described this perfectly, actually, last time I talked to him about it, which was, I enjoy the game while I'm playing it, and then I never think about it when I'm not. And that's really, I think, kind of the problem it has. It's, like, a little too simple. There aren't enough puzzles for you to actually have to piece together. And that left me wanting a better puzzle game. So I was like, you know what? I never did finish Phoenix Wright, the one with Apollo Justice.
4, I think? Ace Attorney 4, I think that is?
I think it is 4, because the first one was a trilogy that's often bundled because they're kind of short, and then 4 was basically just, like, the trilogy length as a single game. So I was looking at that, I'm like... Man, that's $20? I still have that on an emulator somewhere. And I was like scrolling through the shop. I'm like, but for $25, I could get Professor Layton versus Phoenix Wright. So I did. And it's goddamn amazing.
I heard good things about it when it came out.
Those are two things you really like.
Yeah, it is. And you know what's great is it's just like you alternate between playing a Professor Layton game and a Phoenix Wright game. It starts out with a prologue and it's like Professor Layton's like, oh man, I gotta go like uncover this mystery of this random girl who showed up. And like, it's weird though, because like there are Layton characters and they're drawn all cartoony like Layton is. And then there are the slightly more photorealistic anime characters of Phoenix Wright, but most of the world is Phoenix Wright characters. So Layden looks weirdly out of place. It's not, like, too bad.
Have you actually seen one of the cutscenes between all of the characters talking in the Super Robot Wars games?
No, no, I have not.
Because you can definitely tell those are different styles.
It's not too jarring. I got over it really quickly. Like, the game opens with this guy. I'm like, oh, he seems like an interesting character. And then he dies almost immediately. And his name is Carmine Accidente. You want to guess how he dies?
Accidentally.
In a car accident. I'm like, wow, that's really on the nose for a Layton game. And then I remember that it's also a Phoenix Wright game. And all the characters in Phoenix Wright games have pun names. So it, like, goes from Layton, like, trying to track down this girl's, like, mysterious origin. And then he gets, like, sucked into the mystery book world, which is not even a spoiler because it's, like, the prologue. And then it cuts over to Phoenix Wright, who is suddenly defending the mystery book girl who has, like, been brainwashed by a witch who came out of her storybook or something, and you're defending her in trial. And then they get sucked in, and then you're back to Layden, who finds out that Phoenix Wright is a baker in this mystery universe now. And he's wearing a goddamn blue suit and tie. And Layden's like, there seems to be something weird about this guy. He's overly enthusiastic. That's it. So it's really good. It is both a good Layden game already and a good Phoenix Wright game. And I was expecting it to be a subpar either of those. So if you like either of them, I highly, highly recommend it now that it's like, what, a year and a half old or something?
Something like that. Might be 2 years old.
Yeah.
We're very old men, Tyler.
That is true. Time passes differently when you're yelling at kids to get off your lawn. It's been a rap ton of fun. I've lost like 6 hours to it.
I think I took longer to beat Wind Waker from when it came out than I took to beat Link to the Past when it came out. And I did not have a Super Nintendo.
So really, what I've been doing on the Switch mostly was trying really hard not to just buy Breath of the Wild and play it again. So what have you been doing?
Oh, I finished Wind Waker!
Yay!
What did you think, now that you're done?
I have very complicated feelings about Wind Waker. I think it's my least favorite Zelda that came out after I was born.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? I know you didn't think very highly of Majora's Mask for a long time.
I think Majora's Mask has one crippling problem that is solved by save states, which the Wii U version has.
Okay.
Like, I think Majora's Mask does not hold up and has bad gameplay because of very cool, interesting mechanics it's exploring, and I can respect that compromise. Wind Waker's kind of... not, I was going to say all over the place. That's not what I mean. The problem with Wind Waker at the end of the day is the dungeons are too simple.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem.
And dungeons are my favorite part of a Zelda game. That's why I like Skyward Sword and everyone else doesn't.
From what I can tell, the dungeons are kind of the main focus because they're where all the puzzles are. That's coming from a person who's kind of on an outside perspective of a Zelda game.
It's less so in Wind Waker. Wind Waker, at least for me, is a lot more about exploration.
Yeah, so I'm very influenced by Mark Brown's Boss Keys series where he played every Zelda dungeon in order to like figure out how level design in them worked. And he categorized them differently and came up with a way to graph Zelda dungeons.
Oh, cool.
But his criticism of Wind Waker, which I 100% agree with, is all the dungeons are 100% linear.
Yep.
The last dungeon of Wind Waker hides that from you, but all the other ones, it's just go here, go here, go here. And the overworld kind of has that problem, too. The overworld, where you're sailing around, is actually pretty good, I think. The problem with it was made before Breath of the Wild. So it's got all this linear stuff in it it doesn't need. So much of that world doesn't actually unlock until you get the hookshot, which is the item in the last dungeon. And it makes the hookshot, which is my favorite Zelda item, feel like it's just this funny-shaped key for all the content that's supposed to be at the end of the game. Because they give you a grappling hook at the very beginning, which I thought was just the game's take on the hookshot.
But and nope.
Yeah, and it's not my favorite, but it is different and interesting. And so it was pretty fun to play with. But then they just give you the hookshot at the end, and it just feels like, I said, like the key to all the places you couldn't go.
I actually kind of wonder if that's why they didn't put the hookshot in Breath of the Wild.
They said they didn't because they didn't want it to be one of your starting tools. And the more they played around it, adding tools to that game midway through just broke the open world feel they were trying to go for. Like, they considered putting signs on dungeons like, hey, you need the hookshot for this one. But it just wasn't satisfying. So,
well, yeah, because if you're just out exploring and you walk up to a dungeon and it's like, I spent all that time getting up that hill and, you know, climbing up that and struggling, and then you get to it and, you know, basically gives you the no entry unless you have this specific item, which is all the way across the map and you haven't been over there yet.
Yeah,
man, even like, I didn't like that game, but man, would that piss me off.
They do have quick travel, though, so...
And like, yeah, but struggling all the way up there to get to a location that you couldn't quick travel to?
Yeah, no, I'm saying I feel like they probably would have solved it by just having a quick travel point.
And then you gotta go find... Then, I mean, on top of that, you gotta go find it.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of cool to me, because that's like, oh, where do I get this thing? But it could also be frustrating. I agree.
Well, it really depends on how hard you had to struggle to get to where it was.
Yeah. So anyway, I really like Wind Waker's overworld. It's separated into different squares, and basically, kind of like the original Zelda, every screen has a thing you can find. Every square has an island with like a thing to do. But so much of them, like I said, are gated by things, and you don't necessarily know what things.
Until you get there.
And there's been a lot of criticism of the end of Wind Waker, because it has the infamous Triforce quest, where you have to sail all over the ocean finding the 8 pieces of the Triforce. And I think there are lots of things wrong with that quest. But it does make you travel that world, and that was like my favorite part of the game. So there's a lot of stuff I like about it.
My problem is there's a lull in the game right before you're supposed to go find the Triforce, where I went to, like, it's not super clear what you're supposed to be doing, so I went and just traveled the world anyway, and like, and then I had to go do it again after.
Yeah, I can see that would be that'd still be frustrating, because you go spend all this time exploring, because I want to explore, I want to go find all this, and then you get there and you're like, okay, what do I do next? And the game's go exploring. I just did that.
But like, and then you have to keep track of like when you didn't have the items to go do stuff.
And so my defense for this, for me to then criticize it, is I actually found 2 of the Triforce pieces during that lull.
But you can't find all of them.
Yes. But like I said, the reason it makes you do this after is now you have all the items, including the hookshot. So it even more makes it feel like this weird gating tool, because you can't get even the majority of the Triforce pieces without it, which is really frustrating. And if you could get them all beforehand, that would be cool. I also think 2 more like very specific criticisms are, like I said, this game is very linear and handholdy. Up until the Triforce point, it will literally circle on the map the place you're supposed to go.
Yeah, which I was not a huge fan of even when I was first playing this game.
Neither am I, but then that just vanishes, which I think is, like, on a subconscious level, very frustrating, even if you're like me and Tyler and you don't want that circle.
Well, I like having the circle in an open world game so that I know where I'm supposed to go in order to continue.
And therefore you can ignore it.
Then therefore I can ignore it and do anything else I want. But what you were saying about not being able to get them without the funny shaped key, in all honesty, I think if you're going to do something like that, you have everything, you have a way to get everything without finding that little bit, but that makes it easier. Or that should make it easier, but you can do it without getting it.
And like I said, in a post-Breath of the Wild world, this would never happen, and I think a lot of my criticisms are stronger because Breath of the Wild is out. Another thing, just about the frustration, is kind of from a story place, it doesn't really make any sense that you need to find the Triforce now. It wasn't established beforehand. And as far as I can tell, the only reason you need it is so Ganondorf can threaten to steal it from you?
And because otherwise you can't really call it a Zelda game if you haven't found the Triforce?
You don't find it in Ocarina of Time!
Well, that's because Ganon's already found it, right?
Well, yes. Yes, but there are plenty of, like, Majora's Mask, the Triforce does not factor at all. It's an interesting idea, but there's, like, it feels like it comes out of left field, and it's this, like...
Oh, hell, we needed something for this?
Yeah. I wanted to say that I also kind of feel like the compromises the Wii U version were too much. But it does half the length of the quest, and I did something I have not done playing a video game in at least 10 years, which is I turned it off without saving. Like, my dad came in, he's like, hey, we need to talk about what we're going to have for dinner. I'm like, okay, dad, I'll pause this game. Hits power button and holds it for 5 seconds. And I'm like, why did I do that? Jesus Christ, I hope this game has autosave. It doesn't. Crap.
No, because it's an old game.
Well, even then, even a lot of newer games don't have autosave. Like, Persona 5 doesn't have an autosave.
I can see why you wouldn't want that game to have an autosave, though. Because, like, what if you screwed up in how you spent your time with people? Then you need to go back and, like, do that again. I like us having an autosave slot versus, like, an intentional save slot.
And Persona anyway. 5 has a rhythm to its saving, too, because at the end of every day, it's like, hey, do you wanna? Whereas Wind Waker doesn't.
So it's weird to me that you're criticizing Wind Waker for its weak dungeons, given Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, but again, I don't want to talk about Mark Brown too much, but he made different categories of Zelda dungeon, and one is just like the linear dungeon, which is all of Wind Waker's. And then he's got another type that's the puzzle box, where you're like trying to manipulate the dungeon into...
Which is all of Breath of the Wild.
And that's my favorite type of Zelda dungeon. No, that said, the Breath of the Wild dungeon's not the best ones, definitely.
Yeah, so that's something I hope they improve on if they take that idea again.
But I like them more than the Wind Waker ones.
That's fair. I think mostly what I liked about Wind Waker was it's like the exploration and the general character. Like, I still really like Medley as a character.
There's a lot of stuff that's good. Like, while the graphics were very controversial when they came out, it's helped the game hold up tremendously because they still look good in a way that a lot of games from that era do not. The characters are good. The like weird Animal Crossing / Majora's Mask influence on it, where all the characters, even like these minor ones you never have to talk to, have schedules and personalities and lives you can learn about, is all super cool. But that's all side stuff you don't really have to engage with.
Yeah, as opposed to in Majora's Mask, you like you needed to know that stuff about a lot of characters.
I suppose my ultimate criticism of Wind Waker is all of the necessary content is kind of mediocre. All of the side content is very cool.
That's kind of a problem because you're more likely to engage with them. You're supposed to be engaging with the main content, and the main content should be more engaging. I mean, that doesn't mean don't make engaging side content too, especially in an open world exploration focused game, but the main content should be interesting.
Yeah, and I found it charming because I don't think any game would dare like put that much work into content a player could skip if they wanted anymore. And so like that all as background was still pretty cool. But I think that's the reason it took me like 3-4 years to beat this game, is because when I had to go like do a task, it felt like doing my taxes. Whereas like just sailing around, like, oh man, that's a cool ghost ship. I wonder what's up with that. It was pretty cool. Like the grappling hook mechanic where you can just like send a line down for treasure is a super cool, satisfying mechanic.
Like, until you no longer need rupees anymore.
Well, yes. But also that's a, going back to the Triforce quest, it's a rupee sink so that all those rupees you found treasure hunting have a purpose instead of just being this giant number at the bottom of the screen that you don't need to ever use. There's a lot of frustrating things about Wind Waker, but at the end of the day, it is a Zelda game, and that's my favorite franchise. So being on the low end of those, it's still pretty cool, but I'm glad I've beaten it. I don't think I'll ever go back to it.
That's fair.
I guess would be my final statement on it.
And maybe it's just like I really like seafaring adventures because I played Wind Waker 3 times.
Yeah, but so. All before Breath of the Wild came out, right?
That is true.
Like, why would you go back to Wind Waker over Breath of the Wild?
Then I wouldn't.
Yeah, why go back to Wind Waker when you can just play Black Flag instead?
Yeah, also, Black Flag. I think I mentioned a while ago, I was playing Tempest, and I'm like, oh man, this sounds like Black Flag, but with a way higher focus on trading and stuff. And like, everything about the game is worse. It's just like a way worse version of Assassin's Creed. And I don't know why I'd ever play it over Assassin's Creed.
The other game I've been playing is City Skylines. It's just SimCity. I got bored of it. We've been going for an hour, or I'd go more in depth.
Yeah, so you've learned that you don't like SimCity.
Do we want to mention over our Dead by Daylight session?
Oh, we played Dead by Daylight. That was pretty fun.
Yeah,
Zach was a Michael Myers.
I played Michael Myers and caught everybody.
I put 2 bear traps on him and hooked him twice, and he still escaped.
I know that's because I went out of my way to make sure that you did not kill Zach that game.
Well, the thing is, like, Kevin got bear trapped once. Searched like 5. I think he said he searched 5. Boxes and couldn't find a key. I got bear trapped twice. First box I went to, I got it off. It was pretty great. Jeremy finally escaped a level. We got him out.
I should have escaped too, but like a phantom bush snagged my leg and tripped me.
And let Tyler catch 2 people. Or was it Ed?
It was Ed. I escaped Kevin.
Yeah, you escaped, because everyone escaped Kevin.
And lastly, I started Super Robot Wars X. I've only done the prologue. I haven't even done the first mission. I did the like DLC prologue. That's it. I chose the male character. I know it was the incorrect choice, so Zach, please choose the girl and tell me how much better it is.
Okay, I'll work on that. Yeah, I haven't actually gotten a chance to play mine because I had to go on a quest to retrieve mine from the mail because they didn't put it in my mailbox.
So speaking of the wonders of modern society, we played Rise of Nations this week.
This was a game I had a lot of fond memories of. I loved playing this when I was a little kid, but as I've gotten older, like looking back at it, my only thought is, why am I not playing Civ? And I got to admit, first off, I couldn't get this game to run on my PC. I don't know what it was, but for whatever reason, the dang thing wouldn't work right.
Well, you're lucky.
And so I frankly couldn't play a lot of it. Not because I lacked time to play a lot of it when I was playing it. I just could not force myself to play a lot of it.
I played like 4 hours of it over 20-minute spurts because that's all I could bring myself to play. I did finish a couple games. I finished, I think 2 one-on-one matches against the AI and 1 1v3 against the AI. The 1v3s are such a nightmare. But before we get to that, it's an RTS, very similar to Age of Empires, actually. I think it was pretty clearly inspired by those.
It's kind of like Age of Empires meets Civ, because you can go from the ancient eras to modern day.
Yeah, its real gimmick is in its tech tree. You start with not only a town hall, but a library where you can research all sorts of different technologies. But unlike other RTSs where technologies are specific things, there are, I want to say, five different categories. There's military, there's civics, there's science.
I think they're basically all the...
There's commerce.
They're basically all the trees from Civ.
Is there another one? It might just be those four.
I'm trying to think what the last one is, if it exists.
I know it's war, commerce, knowledge, and science.
War, commerce, civics.
Civics.
And science, I think.
It might just be the four.
You could, and also, you can advance ages once you get a certain number of prerequisite techs from those lists. And that's just, you go through age 2 to, I want to say, 7, and then there's also 7 tiers for each of those 4 categories. As you advance in ages, units can be upgraded. So you go from sort of prehistory, just dudes with spears, to tanks and nuclear missiles as you advance along.
Hey, nukes.
Tyler's probably very good with nukes.
I mean, nukes are super easy in this. You just say, nuke there.
Yes, yeah. That is true. Although I do believe that there is a missile shield. Like, you can upgrade a ability to deflect nukes, I think.
Yeah. Once you research all the technologies, there are 4 kind of capstone technologies you can get, and that's one of them.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was remembering that correctly.
So you have workers like most RTSs. You build them at cities, and they're there to gather resources. There are a lot of resources in this game, by which I mean 6.
Which is, like, doesn't seem like a whole lot, but in an RTS, that's, like, too many to manage.
Considering, like, you need to have a certain amount of workers dedicated to each resource because, you know, you need a lot of resources in order to, like, build an army. So, like, Warcraft 3 is a good example. They only have 2. So usually you have 5 workers on any individual gold mine, and then you're expanding. So you got, like, 5 workers there and then a bunch of workers on trees, but they're easier to manage because you only have 2. If you have 6, and it's like, assume you need 5 workers on every one of them. I don't know if you do or not. That's 30 of your population cap just in workers, and you're probably not running at a maximum efficiency.
Unlike most games, you don't need to build an item to increase your population cap. It's under the military technology that does it. You also, the commerce technology affects your limits for how quickly you can bring in resources. You're capped at certain things, no matter how many sources of that you have or how many guys you put on it until you upgrade your commerce.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like that idea. I don't mind the population being attached to one of those, because just having this massive chunk of supply depots or houses or whatever the case may be was always kind of annoying. But forcing a hard limit on the stuff you could gather through an arbitrary thing like that, I don't like. That's too much.
What I don't like more is how little you have to fight for your resources. There are 6 of them, as we said. There's food, which you get by just building farms. You're limited to 5 farms per city. And the civics technology, each time you upgrade it, you can build a new city, which also lets you claim more territory. There's lumber, which is one you actually have to find, but you don't expend trees once you find them. Once you build a lumber camp, you can harvest it forever. There are mines, which are similar. You build them in mountains, but again, you never run out of metal there.
And so it feels a lot like a turn-based strategy in that you just, like,
it feels very Civ, because, like, that's one of those things about real-time strategy games is fighting for your resources. Having to fight over those things is actually important.
Yeah, in turn-based strategies, you just need to protect those things. Generally, Civ, you don't ever really lose them unless you lose the territory. Well, I guess you do have to protect them, kind of.
Well, yeah, you kind of have to protect them, but
it's more abstract.
You're not relying on them to bring in a certain number of resources turn by turn. Like, if you have a source of iron, you just have a certain amount of iron that you can use.
I was going to say, you haven't played Heroes of Might and Magic. Like, that's a turn-based strategy where you do actually require it to bring in turn by turn, or you lose. So,
but yeah, my real criticism is there's not much to fight over. There are unique resources that will give you, like, plus 10% lumber or something, but they're random and not usually powerful enough to really wage war over.
They're more of a bonus if somebody has them when you happen to take that territory, because you're at war with them for other reasons anyway.
And your limits on how much resources you make you want to expand to new cities, which is good, but it just means in the end you have too much territory to meaningfully defend, because you have to have so many workers. and so much of your population cap is devoted to that, which is an idea I honestly like, but it means your military has to be small, which means you either divide it and get beaten by larger militaries while you're trying to move your forces around, or you keep it in one place and are vulnerable to being flanked or attacked on other ends. And it just makes the combat really unsatisfying. The units are also very rock-paper-scissory. You have, for example, cavalry units that get beat by spearmen. They will later just become tanks when you upgrade them, but then they get beat by anti-tank rifles. And just the combat's very rock-paper-scissory. Units don't have special abilities, with two exceptions. So the combat is really just kind of mashing two armies against each other and hoping you rock-paper-scissored better.
Which, like Jeremy said, that's really unsatisfying. I mean, yeah, when I played StarCraft, I generally ran with the Marine, Marauder, and Medivac strategy because I'm not that great on that kind of thing. But even then, that strategy, while simple, had its benefits and advantages, but it also had its weaknesses. And on all counts, were, you know, both sides, there were the weaknesses that you could use against it were potent, but the formation itself was okay. But it didn't get beaten just by virtue of somebody rock, paper, scissors something.
Yeah, they're just effective meta strategies, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's all it really was. I mean, it was vulnerable to, like, splash damage, but just because somebody built splash damage didn't, by virtue of them having it, immediately beat the strategy.
And the fact that units upgrade throughout the match is kind of cool, but it just is too abstract for me. It makes all the units feel like they're the same, especially, in particular, horsemen becoming tanks all of a sudden, and your stable becoming an auto factory just really has a disconnect for me. And like I said, it just makes all the units feel the same. It's also pretty difficult to tell, like, the difference between a spearman and a heavy spearman in the early era upgrades, so it's hard to tell where your opponent is. It doesn't read very well, and it's not very fun to play out. There are two units with abilities, the Spy and the General, but even those aren't that exciting. They're not, like, huge game turners the way casters in StarCraft or Warcraft can be.
Or even the... Those are Empire Priest and Prophet. Prophets could actually cast, like, disasters.
I think I must have played Empire Earth.
But, like, the priests from Age of Empires, even.
In the late game, you get air units, which play a bit differently, but they're just another thing to manage. And, like, it just gets to be too much. You have too many resources, too many cities, and too many units by the end, and it's not fun even when you're winning.
I think it's a good example as to why you see a lot of RTSs generally only have a couple of resources. A lot of them, you know, might have just, like, the one that you have to gather and then the one you can generate for whatever reason. Like, I remember Command & Conquer Generals, they only had one resource, really, that you had to gather, and that was just supplies, just general supplies. But you also had power that you had to manage. It wasn't something you gathered. It was just you have X amount of power.
Now, how do you allocate that?
Yeah, so, like, managing more than a couple of resources gets a little annoying and tedious because, like, I want to do X. I don't have enough of Y resource because I'm not currently generating Y resource because I have all of my guys on Z resource because I also needed Z resources to build X.
And if you play RTS games, the strategy always is never have a resource banked. Always be spending your resource. But by the end game, you're generating stuff so fast, you just can't do that no matter how many barracks you create. And you run out of space because you have to build so many buildings, even though you have all this territory. The game just doesn't work, in my opinion. It's too complicated and kind of crushes itself under its own weight.
Which is a little sad, because as a concept, like, real-time Civ sounds amazing, right?
But I think there's a reason no one's really tried it. I think there's a reason Civ is better off as turn-based.
Yeah, I think Jeremy's right. I mean, on that kind of, like, going through the ages, I think Empire Earth, I think, does it a little bit better, because in actuality, the game of Empire Earth is a bit bigger. The maps, on average, are bigger, and a lot of times the matches take longer. But you also get to go into the future and get, like, cool future tech stuff, like mechs are a thing in that one. I think this one just kind of hurts itself by trying too much, but at the same time not doing enough.
Two more bullet points. I think we've kind of wrapped this up, but two bullet points we kind of skipped on the list. There are different nations you can choose from, like Japan, Britain, Aztecs. They have certain advantages and unique units. Unfortunately, I always found they kind of washed out because of how complex the game gets at the end. But it is a cool way to try to make things a little distinct, even if it's no Zerg, Terran, Protoss.
Well, Zerg, Terran, Protoss is one of those things that's really hard to actually match. That's such a fantastic way of going about it. The other thing that I think we need to mention is, in the late game, you can get nuclear weapons. And from the time somebody launches a nuke, it starts a countdown timer, and every time
clock.
And every time somebody fires a nuke, that clock ticks down. If that clock ever hits zero, the game is over and everybody loses.
Which kind of disincentivizes, like, the dead man hands strategy, but...
But at the same time, nukes are still really, really potent weapons. So it ends up being kind of a, do I use this because I can easily win a fight with it? Or do I hold on to it and hope the other team doesn't start using them?
It also incentivizes using nukes very quickly. Because if you get it down to one, anyone who launches a nuke achieve mutually assured destruction automatically.
Yep.
It's also kind of an interesting political statement. Civ does similar things with nukes as well in the endgame. It's more about degrading resources slowly and the slow, crippling, choking death of every player instead of an immediate one. But
I have actually never fired a nuke in Civ.
Yeah, me neither, actually.
They're not that good, actually, in Civ.
I usually end up winning by... If I'm winning through force of arms, I just have such a large army of, like, artillery and tanks and stuff that I just roll over stuff.
And I almost always win by culture or technology. I was going to say, before we started recording, you said, like, you remember when you played this game as a kid, you remember that the combat was more or less uninteresting enough that you tended to rely on nukes just to avoid the combat.
Well, I was thinking at the time, I felt very, very clever. I'm going to use nukes in order to... Because taking a capital city would immediately conquer the entire nation. So you nuke everything until they move their capital city close to your territorial borders. And then just immediately conquer it. But then thinking about it, I'm like, well, why would I do that instead of just building up an army? And the answer is, because I've got so many workers and stuff that I don't have enough people to really build an actual army. And the combat just in general wasn't
great.
Interesting enough in order to try and learn it and improve at it. Like, say, StarCraft.
Do we have any other final thoughts? I kind of feel like I've gotten mine out.
I mean, I don't know. We've been kind of dumping on this game a lot. It's not terrible.
The problem is that it's very mediocre. It's functional. It worked when I played it when I was a little kid. Obviously, I had technical problems this time around. But it's not the worst thing I've ever played.
It's
but at the same time,
but like, I don't know why I'd spend my free time with this instead of...
And at this point in my life, I've played so many better strategy games. StarCraft, even Civ, Warcraft 3. All these games are just so much better than this one that I'm not sure why I would pick this one up out of the pack.
So speaking of games we'd rather pick up than this, we have a list on our website, www.lasttimeonvideogames.com, listing all the games we've played from best to worst. At the top is Chrono Trigger, a game that doesn't actually go through the eras too much, despite being about time travel and having a robot future and a magic past. At the bottom is City Connection. Yeah, that's a game.
You travel.
Yeah.
And it takes time.
That's another game I'd rather not play.
It's a game I'd rather not remember.
In the center, we have Blades of Steel.
That game has time limits.
Yes,
and you pass... I can't even remember.
You get the best.
Just yeah. No.
So the most comparable game to this is Age of Empires 2, which we have way up there at number 33. I think this game is a lot worse than that, though.
Yeah, Age of Empires doesn't span the same degree, and it doesn't have quite the same level of specialty units, but at the same time, it maintains a more tight focus than this game does. So I would have to say that Rise of Nations is worse than Age of Empires 2.
I think I agree. I think it's unfortunate that there are a lot of games that are like, wow, that's really ambitious, but unfortunately neither part of what they're doing is focused enough.
So almost 100 spots down at number 130, we have Impossible Creatures.
Huh.
Another RTS game we played that I think is pretty comparable in that I was pretty critical of that one because I didn't find it fun and I found the combat to be kind of boring. But I think I like Impossible Creatures a little more because it has that army building aspect and you get to at least build your rock, your paper, and your scissors before you send it up against your opponents. And it does have special abilities, even if they're kind of bland and uninspired.
Yeah, I think Impossible Creatures trying to give you the ability to kind of customize your strategy. I don't think it worked great when you actually got into the point of executing, but I think I agree with Jeremy here.
It's a cool concept, but man, I'm a sucker for tech trees. I think I'd actually have to give it to Rise of Nations.
But you're outvoted.
But I'm outvoted, yeah. I knew that when I said it.
I
just felt like there needed to be a dissenting opinion.
I'm really interested to see how exactly the other Relic RTS stacks up.
Which is?
Dawn of War.
Ah. They made that after this, right?
I don't remember where they fall
okay.
In comparison to one another. I just know that there's another strategy game I want to play before I play Dawn of War for this podcast.
So the next strategy game on the list is Nobunaga's Ambition. That game's a little more...
obtuse?
Yeah, that's the word I want. Thank you. But I actually think I like Nobunaga's Ambition a little bit more as well, if just because it didn't like have that crushing sense of ennui.
I thought Nobunaga's Ambition was too complicated and confusing, and I actually got that sense of, why am I doing this again, when I was trying to play that one. I'd have to give it to Rise of Nations.
I actually like Nobunaga's Ambition a little bit better, partially because it's simpler, and also partially because it's felt like I understood how that game worked after just playing with the system a little bit.
You really?
Yeah.
I didn't understand that game one whit.
All right, so speaking of obtuse, the next strategy game down is XCOM UFO Defense.
And like, man, I really wanted to like XCOM, but no.
I love the remake of this game. I do not like the original.
For some of the reasons to Impossible Creatures, though, I think I prefer XCOM. If just because it's a little bit more inventive, I did get that sense of ennui and why am I doing this with XCOM, but at least its mechanics felt like they served a purpose to me.
Although there's a lot of random in XCOM that just like screws you over.
I think we're in the right area, but I would still give it to XCOM.
And so the negative feedback loop, knowing that you're going to go under, like you don't get a sense of ennui with that.
Not as bad as this.
I do really like the concept of XCOM though, and there's so much, like it feels like there's a good game there. Somewhere.
Yeah, they polished it and called it XCOM Enemy Unknown.
Yeah.
I'd probably give it to Rise of Nations, because the first XCOM was a little too confusing, hard to get into.
Needed a manual.
Needed a big manual.
So I suppose that leaves it up to me.
It does.
I think I would have to give it with XCOM, just on level of sheer ambition. There are so many more mechanics in that game. I feel like if you took the time to learn all of them, you could have a lot more fun with it.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, when they did remake the game to be a lot better,
they streamlined the hell out of it. They took a lot of stuff out, and I think that's to its benefit, frankly.
So the next strategy game we have on the list is Lords of the Realm 2. And while that game is more focused and I think I like it a little more than this, I think that is where I draw the line, because the combat system in both is boring, but I think it works a little better in Rise of Nations, if just because watching your units get upgraded is kind of fun.
Lords of the Realm 2 had the problem of terrible pathfinding in AI, so sometimes you'd have your guys engage and half your army would be like, alright, cool story, bro.
I also felt like, frankly, there's less choice in Lords of the Realm, like there's just an optimal strategy, and I agree, I would have to give it to Rise of Nations.
I agree, I like the idea behind Lords of the Realm 2, but in all honesty, that idea kind of came up as Stronghold.
Smack dab in the middle between Lords of the Realm 2 and XCOM, a game Zach has not played, but one that I think is very comparable, is ActRaiser, which is half a strategy game.
Yeah, it's half a strategy game and half a platformer.
And neither of those is great, but I think both are better than Rise of Nations.
Really?
Yeah, I have a lot more fun like with that little Cherub God minigame RTS, getting my people music or whatever, than I do with this. And while we were very critical, I think for good reason, of ActRaiser's platforming, it is serviceable. I'd much rather do an ActRaiser platforming level than fight a battle in Rise of Nations.
Huh. Until you get to the boss, and then you just have to like sit there and frustratingly button mash the boss.
Yeah, but I'd still rather do that.
They're
very similar bad feelings, but like the boss is at least a little easier to deal with. Like with the boss, if I die, I don't have to recreate my entire army and then do it again.
And I do really like the weird turn-based real-time strategy elements in ActRaiser, even if they're simple. It's just really satisfying to see things progress in that game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you have swayed me.
So right below ActRaiser is Thief, which is a weird comparison, but it's better than the other one we got.
I prefer Thief. Pretty handily, actually.
I don't really care for stealth too much. I'd take it Rise of Nations.
I think I prefer Thief. I think Thief is just a little more ambitious. It's not like a great preference, but yeah, just thinking of the two, I would way rather play Thief right now. Rise of Nations, just like I said, really filled with ennui. So the final question, is this game better or worse than Wave Race 64? A game I was not there to defend when we originally recorded the podcast, and that I would have tried to put higher. Not too much higher, but higher. So I think just based on that, I'm going to go with Wave Race. I have some nice fond memories of that.
Based on the fact that I think it should be above Thief, I'm going to go with Rise of Nations.
I think I'm actually going to have to agree with Zach, not because he thinks it goes above Thief, but because I think there's just much more going on. Like, Wave Race is so bare bones to me.
Wasn't Wave Race a launch title for the 64?
It was. I mean, it was a surprisingly okay launch title.
But it wasn't a bad game. It's just, I say that, and I was also trying to figure out why exactly. You know, do I actually have an argument against Wave Race? And I think the answer is kind of what you said, Tyler. There's just not a whole lot there.
Yeah, so we're in the land of the mediocre and the critically flawed gems.
So Rise of Nations will go at number 147, above Wave Race and below Thief.
And I don't think it's quite in spitting distance of games never to touch.
Yeah, I mean, it's on the lower half of the list, but only barely.
That's fine to be on the lower half of the list.
I think it might be on the same page as... It's on the same page as Alex Kidd and Miracle World. Now, they're pretty separated, but they are on the same page. Oh yeah, Earthworm Jim is at the bottom of this page, so...
I like how we're doing it by pages.
Well, what else would we do, Hibai? So it's not quite there, but it is. It can see it. Oh, if it stands up on the hill, it can see it. If it gets that helicopter right, it can see Death, Alaska.
So, Jeremy, since our nation is clearly falling, what are we playing next time?
Well, it's been a long time since we've played a Mega Man game, and those are always reliable, if samey. But unfortunately,
I thought that's why we stopped playing them.
Unfortunately, the next one on the list is a Game Boy one. I think that's why we stopped playing them. Because those the NES ones are going downhill. The Game Boy ones are going downhill fast. But I got my 3DS back, so there's no real avoiding it anymore. We got to play it eventually. We're going to do Mega Man 3 Roman numeral for the Game Boy.
All right.
Didn't for the NES have Pharaoh Man?
That was 4.
Already played 4?
Yeah.
I saw it.
What was 3? I don't even remember.
Oh, that's the one Zach doesn't like because it freezes. And by freezes, I mean slows down.
Oh, with the Gemini laser? Yeah. And okay, I remember that game.
I saw an advertisement for Call of Duty Black Ops 4 has been announced, and it's just 4 hash marks. I'm like, that's not how Roman numerals work.
So next time on Last Time, we're counting it like WrestleManias. This has been a production of Last Time on Video Games, copyright 2018. All games, movies, and other media mentioned in this podcast are copyright their respective owners. If you wish to listen to more episodes, visit us at www.lasttimeonvideogames.com, where you can see the entire archive. If you wish to get in contact with us, you can email us at ltovg@lasttimeonvideogames.com. This episode is over. Try listening to another one?